wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Before we get started, let me remind you that we're in the middle of a drive here at KBOO, focusing on bringing you different themed days of special programming. All thrills, no frills, it's called. To support this station and the Old Mole Variety Hour, go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321 and become a monthly sustaining member. Today, you can help reach our fundraising goal of $17,000 right now, if you would, by going to kboo.fm/give. Today, Bill Resnick talks to Jesse Hagopian about the recent Florida law, the so-called Stop Woke Act. Book mole Larry Bolden reviews One Brilliant Flame by Joy Castro. And Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken preview the film Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, which premieres at Cinema 21 this Sunday, March 12th. First up, Bill Resnick talks to Jesse Hagopian, author of Teaching for Black Lives, about Florida's Governor Ronald DeSantis and his Stop Woke Act, which aims to criminalize the teaching of black history. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with Jesse Hagopian for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, Jesse Hagopian. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hey, it's good to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Hagopian teaches at Seattle's Garfield High School. It's well known for being the first of many to resist high-stakes testing and teaching to the test. They boycotted them, just ignored them. Just incidentally, Jesse Hagopian wrote the book, More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High-Stakes Testing. In January of 2015, Jesse gave the final speech at Seattle's Martin Luther King Day rally. Not long after, he was pepper sprayed, no provocation, by a Seattle police officer. This videotaped by an onlooker. Jesse sued the city. He won and used the bulk of the money to start the Black Education Matters Student Activist Award. Jesse's an influential and prolific writer, many articles, several books. Recently, the book Teaching for Black Lives. It's not yet banned on the bookshelves of Florida schools, but it surely will be soon. Jesse's been closely following the actions of Florida's Governor Ronald DeSantis and the Florida legislature, who've gone on a crusade against the teaching of black history, not just banning books, but limiting what can be taught, claiming that critical race theory is itself racist, racist against whites, that whites are now the victims of racism, their children indoctrinated to hate their country and turn against their parents, making good kids feel uncomfortable and guilty, and making school administrators responsible to root out this racist teaching, firing teachers who they and a few parents might find objectionable. So, Jesse, let's start with a summary of the law and DeSantis' justifications and the falsity of their arguments. And then we can discuss the impacts on other states, on the schools, on teaching, why these conservative reactionaries are doing it. We'll conclude with the fight back across the country seeking to protect the great bulk of scholarship on race. First, though, Jesse, again, summarize the law and DeSantis' justifications and how false they are.
Yeah, the attack on public education, on black history, on trans and queer students in Florida is truly breathtaking. They have the Stop Woke Act that outlaws truth in the classroom. It would require teachers to lie to students about structural racism and American history by outlawing any discussions about how racism goes beyond personal attitudes and instead is built into the structures and systems of the country. And with the recent banning of books in Florida, it has really gotten to a whole nother level that resembles the McCarthy era. You have a situation in Florida where it is now a third-degree felony to have the wrong books on your classroom bookshelf. It's truly astounding that a teacher could face 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine for having a book about Hank Aaron on their bookshelf. That was one of the books that was removed from the classroom.
About Hank Aaron. The Hammer is the name of the book. Is it that one?
Yeah.
The book banned was for third graders that told children about the racism of the South that he grew up with and the intense racism that brought him 9,700 letters when he was closing in on breaking Babe Ruth's home run record. Many were hate threats, a good number, and vicious hate threats and threats against his family, hundreds. He wrote another book, I Had a Hammer, for students, for fellow athletes, and the toll that racism took on blacks. In the book that he wrote this, and I Had a Hammer, when his 22 record-setting years ended, he told the whole story of constant insults and death threats and how racism is not ended. It just operates differently. That book was titled I Had a Hammer. The hammer was the nickname coined by opposing pitchers. It also referenced the song, If I Had a Hammer, famous civil rights song. Henry Aaron died at 84, a beloved athlete, an unwaveringly honest and critical advocate for black lives.
Yeah, it's such a waste of energy and time and money to be policing the curriculum of Florida students rather than empowering educators to teach to their passions. And, you know, I work with the Zen Education Project, and we've received many different notes from teachers in Florida who talk about being worried about teaching about slavery or being worried about assigning a book about black history and the chilling effect that it's having, where you have teachers who want to help students understand how racism functions in our society, help them appreciate the contributions that black people have made to American history. But they're afraid to say anything about black people because they could get sued or fired. And I talked to one teacher in particular, Amy Donoforio, who taught at a school named Robert E. Lee High School in Florida, you know, named after the Confederate general who led his armies to help kill thousands of people to maintain slavery. And she believed in a school named after somebody who wanted to perpetrate a genocide in order to maintain slavery, that she needed to let her black students know that they mattered. And she put up a flag in her classroom that said Black Lives Matter so that her students would know that this was a sanctuary, a safe place for them. And for that, she was fired. And this was an award-winning teacher who started a program to help black youth, labeling them at hope rather than at risk, and helping them develop their speaking skills and leadership qualities. And she was invited to the White House with her class when Obama was in office, and her students provided training for politicians all over the area. And despite these incredible contributions, she was summarily dismissed. And this happened right at the same time the Stop Woke Law was coming online. And you can see that they want to intimidate teachers who are doing an incredible job empowering their black youth.
Yeah. What are DeSantis's justifications for it? And why are these reactionaries doing it? There's a bunch of reasons, I think, but I think we have to really understand where they're coming from. Tell us what he's arguing.
Sure. I mean, Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida has put forward these anti-history laws claiming that if you talk about black history, if you talk about the incredible contributions of black people to this country and their struggles against systemic racism, that it's about shaming white kids. And that's the mantra they repeat over and over again, that any discussion of racism will cause white students to feel discomfort. So they've passed these laws that some have called white comfort laws to erase these discussions in the classroom. And it is a complete fabrication because social justice teachers teaching about race and racism in the class aren't interested in shaming white students at all. In fact, they want to empower white students with the knowledge of important anti-racist traditions that exist among white people. You know, I teach my students about the long tradition of anti-racist white people. When we look at the American Revolution, we look at the ideas of Thomas Paine, who wrote the book Common Sense, you know, one of the best-selling books of all time. And he made a huge contribution to the American Revolution, but he also argued against the other so-called founding fathers, saying that you can't have slavery and democracy at the same time. You have to pick one or the other. And he wanted to choose democracy and ending slavery. And so, you know, we look at the system of slavery through the eyes of the abolitionists, including people like John Brown, a white abolitionist who gave his life to fight against slavery. There's a long tradition of anti-racist white people joining struggles for racial justice that I want my white students to know about so they can make a decision about what side they want to be on in the struggles today. And I teach them that they have a choice to make, right? They can go along with the status quo, or they can look at this incredible history and choose to join in the struggles for justice today. And I think that that's what they really fear. That's what Ron DeSantis really fears. He knows we're not shaming white kids. What he's really afraid of is that we're empowering white students to join struggles for racial justice. And in fact, I think that when you don't teach white students about systemic racism, that can actually lead to shame. Because when white students see racism all around them, they know that they're in segregated schools and segregated classrooms. They have friends and peers who are Black and people of color, and they know that these students are getting harassed by police, getting followed in stores. And if there isn't a systemic explanation for where racism comes from, then white students often come to blame themselves for the entire structures in society, rather than see how structural racism can influence institutions regardless of what the intentions of the people are in those institutions. And so we want to empower them with the knowledge of how structural racism works and how they can be part of the struggle to undo it.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Jesse Hagopian. He teaches at Seattle's Garfield High School, well known for its disciplined and militant walkouts even before the George Floyd Black Lives Matter struggle. Jesse's one of the leaders of Garfield's Black faculty. Jesse also contributes a lot to the Black teachers' organizations in Seattle and in the country. He's an influential, prolific writer, many articles, several books. He's one of the co-founders and editor for the magazine Rethinking Schools. He's recently authored and edited the book Teaching for Black Lives. It's not yet banned on the bookshelves of Florida schools. It surely will be soon, because Jesse's been closely following the actions of Florida's Governor Ronald DeSantis and the Florida legislature, who have gone on a crusade against the teaching of Black history. So far, Jesse Hagopian and I have discussed the law, its many fabrications, falsifications, deceit, and why the laws were pushed by DeSantis and enacted. So, Jesse, DeSantis' version of Black history echoes the conservative line that the racism of the past has been defeated in the United States. In fact, the glory of Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement, it succeeded. It shows the glory of America. In fact, it's now the Black radicals and their supporters who have become racist, blaming whites and making students, as you pointed out, feel guilty and demean their country. How do you deal with that sort of point of view? How great it is. We had a Black president. Blacks have equal opportunity. In fact, they get privileged. And that's wrong, says the DeSantis set. That's racism victimizing whites, according to them. So, Jesse, how do you deal with that set of ideas?
Yeah, well, I think that they try to use the image of Martin Luther King, claim that any discussion about racism today is contrary to King's idea that we should judge people by the content of their character, not the color of their skin, right? And so they claim that anytime you discuss race, you are going against Martin Luther King, which is one of the most absurd claims and falls apart upon just a cursory glance at the evidence. I mean, they want to quote that one part of Martin Luther King's speech about the content of their character, but they don't even want to look at the whole I Have a Dream speech, because if they quoted from the entire speech, they would find another passage in the I Have a Dream speech where he condemns police brutality against black people, right? And imagine a teacher in Florida condemning police brutality against black people. They would be charged with critical race theory. They would be fired summarily, and if they were lucky, they wouldn't get charged with a felony, right? This is the absurdity that we've gotten to, where they cherry-pick one line from Martin Luther King's speech, but if you teach the rest of the speech, you can be in trouble. And so their claims that we're in a post-racial society fall apart with just a very elementary look at the demographics of our society. I mean, there are just so many ways to look at how structural racism continues. You know, the average white family has 10 times the wealth of the average black family. A black woman is 3 times more likely to die in childbirth or from childbearing complications, right? Hate crimes against Asian Americans have skyrocketed over 160%. Since COVID-19. Racism is all around us, and talking about it is not about shaming white people. It's about taking down structures that are creating barriers to democracy and to justice in our country. And our students are ready for these conversations. You know, it was the 2020 uprising when millions of young people were leading a movement for black lives in the streets. And when they came back to school, they were demanding answers from their teachers. They were the ones that said, we want to know, how is it that Breonna Taylor can be shot in her own home while she's asleep and there's no justice? They want to know, how is it that a man can plead for his life with an officer's knee on his neck and be killed for the world to see? They wanted to know, why is it that we go to segregated schools, and why have we not learned black history? And they began asking their teachers these questions, and teachers began responding by having to learn more themselves and allowing for these discussions. And that's really what scared people like Governor Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, and the rest of the history deniers, because they know that if students are empowered with the understanding of how movements for social justice have been organized in the past, that they'll be more effective in organizing those very movements today.
Yeah, you know, I like to cite many, many, many methodologically invulnerable studies. Almost every institution in American life, renting an apartment, buying a house, getting the proper medical care, when they go through black and white patients, the only difference, and people from the same, with the same amount of education and income and the rest, they find that, in fact, for heart attacks, white people get a lot more attention and far less mistakes in dealing with the problem, or renting an apartment to, well, in fact, in getting a job. The only difference between the application, a response to an ad, a want, help wanted ad, the only difference in the entire process is that the black resume, the one resume has a black name, an easily identifiable black name. And the other resume has just a standard white name. In fact, the one that has an English, all the old English names there. Anyway, it's the there's the returns from the enterprises go that the fellow with the black name, exactly the same credentials as the one with the white name, gets written back to schedule an appointment, an employment interview. It's incredible how these completely methodologically invulnerable studies find racism in almost every institutional, certainly schools. And anyway, Jesse, you went into why they're doing it, why DeSantis is so opposed to and criminalizing teaching black history. And one reason that you gave was that in learning black history, white students, in fact, learn about the many white people and organizations that fought racism and fought for abolition and fought against Jim Crow and fought against then the Jim Crow America and are continuing to fight. And DeSantis is afraid politically of the growing incapacity of conservatives to pit black people against white people, for example, in the unions and other struggles where employers intentionally pitted blacks against whites to stop their organizing.
Bill Resnick talking to Jesse Hagopian, noted black educator at Garfield High School. He has many articles on school reform and developing critical engaging curriculums, and several books, including Black Lives Matter at School, Teaching for Black Lives, and Teacher Unions and Social Justice. And he edited the book More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing. In part two next week, they continue discussing the real black history being taught and the resistance and fight back against the laws. So tune in next week for more of this interview with Jesse Hagopian. Chemical Brothers on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the track titled Where Do I Begin? Following Bill Resnick talking with Jesse Hagopian. A reminder that KBOO is in the middle of its All Thrills, No Frills drive. Check out all the programming at kboo.fm/thrills. And while you're there at the website, become a member right now at kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. If you like, one way or the other, we need you to show your support for KBOO and programs like this one by pledging your support. That website again is kboo.fm/give. Up next, Joy Castro's novel One Brilliant Flame is a story about Cuba's fight for independence from Spain and the role that Key West played in that struggle. Bookmole Larry Bolden reviews the book in recognition of Women's History Month. Here's Patricia Kohlberg reading for Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is Patricia Kohlberg reading a book review by Larry Bolden. Joy Castro is a brilliant writer of historical fiction. Many of you readers will know her for her novel, Flight Risk. Today, I want to talk to you about her 2023 novel, One Brilliant Flame. In her afterword entitled Gratitude, she explains part of her motive for writing the book. Quote, "For most of my life, and I am 54 now, I knew nothing about the political history of Key West or its importance as a rebel base for the anti-colonial insurgency in Cuba. It is a moment in U.S. history that has been largely forgotten or erased, a utopian moment of hope for true racial and gender equality. Unfortunately, it was eclipsed by Key West's Great Fire and the events that followed. End quote. My ignorance is much more profound than hers, and I found this novel to be fascinating on so many levels. Besides the well-researched historical content, she also creates a wonderful cast of characters and a juicy story. Most of her lead characters are girls or women. Chiveta is a powerful figure who begins working in a cigar factory at the age of 12, stripping and cleaning tobacco leaves. Quote, "By the time I was 12 and the Flores Cubana factory would hire me, I was already the fastest stripper on the bench. I worked for only a year on the top floor with the other children and some women with smaller hands before they moved me down to the main floor. At 13, I became the youngest roller in a shop of 500 souls." End quote. Zenaida is a young writer, a girl who writes poetry, unheard of, and also a roller who is paid by the number of cigars she rolls in a day. Sophia is the very much spoiled daughter of the owner of the factory, contemptuous of the servants and all those she considers beneath her. She is imperious, but distrusts boys and men, and means to stay clear of them until her father dies and makes her a rich, free woman. Feliciano is a rebel fighter who fights for the liberation of Cuba from Spain, and unlike most of his fellow fighters, sees freedom for Cuba must be linked to freedom of girls and women. As his friend Chiveta points out, quote, "If you are willing to kill and die for Cuba to be free," she glanced around, sweeping the whole auditorium with her gaze, "then must you not also liberate every girl and woman in your midst? Must we not all be let alone, free and unmolested, to do as we will, and to choose whomever we want, or choose no one at all?" End quote. Every year in the town, there is a pageant held to decide on the most desirable girl in the village. All the mothers seem eager to have their daughters appear at the pageant, partly for the monetary reward, but more simply for the recognition. But even Sophia, usually the good girl who curries favor with the older, more conservative members of the community, senses the pageant stage is not so far removed from the auction block. Quote, "There in a row with other girls to demonstrate our figures and fine posture, gazed at by hundreds of eagerly chattering Cubans, I could not help thinking of the auction block." End quote. Among the many political discussions on how to liberate Cuba and whether or not to enlist the help of Americans, the topic of art arises, what it is, and whether it can ever be used politically without compromising it. Poetry begins to appear on walls in town and shows the rift between various factions fighting for Cuba's independence. The factory owners certainly have different interests and goals than the factory workers and the rebel fighters. The radical poet is named The Thorn, and everyone assumes the writer is a man. Women can't write poetry. Of course, eventually, the town is in for a surprise. A tremendous fire destroys Key West and 16 of its cigar factories and essentially quells the dreamed-of rebellion. Quote, "When I was growing up, the period of Caribbean U.S. history was not taught in public school or college. In my own lifetime, we were mostly poor and marginalized people. My father and older relatives never talked about the past." End quote. Joy Castro is determined to talk about it and to educate the rest of us about this unique time and place in history. The novel is worth reading for the story standing alone, but the historical significance is obvious. I have been talking about Joy Castro's novel, One Brilliant Flame. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I am Patricia Kohlberg, reading today for Larry Bolden.
What is Jazz by Ursula 1000, following Patricia Kohlberg, reading for Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Have you supported this yet? Get over there. Visit kboo.fm/give. Show your support for the station and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Finally, this episode, there's a new push to bring nuclear energy back to the Pacific Northwest. A new documentary by filmmaker Jan Hocken takes a skeptical look at the history of nuclear power and the new small modular nuclear reactors. Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken preview the film Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, which premieres this Sunday, March 12th, at Cinema 21. Here's Patricia Kohlberg and Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm here today with Jan Hocken, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, whose latest film investigates the controversy around small modular nuclear reactors, or SMRs. The film is called Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance, and it will have its premiere showing at Cinema 21 on Sunday, March 12th. Now, SMRs are increasingly touted as a key solution to global warming. And even a number of mainstream environmental organizations are endorsing nuclear power as part of the climate solution. Jan, what I want to start with today is why you decided to make this particular film in this moment, right now.
Well, the project grew out of the last documentary film on climate activism, titled Necessity, Climate Justice and the Thin Green Line. And it features a number of climate activists and tribal leaders, including Kathy Sampson Crusa, a member of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, who was speaking throughout that project at rallies and gatherings focused on fossil fuels, on also the threat of campaigns to revive nuclear power with these small modular reactors. And initially, I thought of her calling out nuclear as kind of a distraction from our main message here, which is fighting fossil fuel transport terminals and rail, particularly through our region. But as I looked into the issue of nuclear power, because she kind of urged me to take a look at this, it was not on the radar of many environmental groups in the area. And I think the industry had gathered some support from some environmental groups, not all of them, for sure. So as I looked into this issue, I thought, this is something coming down on us pretty hard and heavy right now. The campaigns for these small modular reactors have been packaged in a way that's informed by all of the critiques of the nuclear industry more generally. And they've now been selling these reactor designs as benign, friendly, kind of feminizing and domesticating the nuclear energy and its online footprint to make it a smaller one, including that these are important steps in responding to the climate crisis. And this was also leading to different proposals in the Northwest to revive the nuclear industry. So the timeliness of those campaigns and the push for reviving nuclear in response to climate crisis gave a kind of urgency to do something on this pretty soon. So this was a film that came out of a sense of urgency, particularly as we're vulnerable to false appeals and false solutions to a very real crisis we face.
And supposedly in Oregon, we don't really need to worry about this because in 1980, in the wake of the Three Mile Island accident, when a meltdown was narrowly avoided, Oregonians actually voted to ban the licensing of any new nuclear facilities in Oregon unless it was approved by voters and unless there was a national depository for nuclear waste, which of course we don't have. So why do we have to be worried in Oregon if you can't build them here?
I think that ballot measure that passed was also the product of very creative, committed organizing here in the Northwest, in Oregon. And the stories that I think have been lost and left behind, certainly not part of the collective memory of younger people, are very instructive in how we respond now to campaigns for an industry that has always touted itself as kind of the embodiment of modernity, as modern, futuristic, clean rather than dirty. As a young industry, it's been a young industry for World War II, and it still touts itself as a young industry, futuristic. And the anti-nuclear movement here, the campaign against Trojan, which did succeed in 1993, combination of a number of problems with the reactor and anti-nuclear activism led to the closure of Trojan and then its decommissioning in 2006. I think the lessons of that era, decades of anti-nuclear activism focused on Trojan here, are really instructive for where we are now. And I wanted those lessons to be kind of recovered, a recovered part of our history and memory that can orient us to some of the risks of many of these extractive industries that are so destructive, but the ways in which the nuclear industry has cloaked itself in secrecy, in a set of disguises that have either downplayed or downright denied the risks that they pose for public safety and public health, not aside from just the costs.
Yeah, I want to get back to some of those points, but here in Oregon, in fact, the ban on nuclear power plants is being challenged right now, which is another reason that this film is so timely. There are two ballot measures before the legislature at the moment to, in one way or another, overturn that ban and allow the industry to develop within the state of Oregon.
Yeah, there are several that are bills that would put this before voters again, and a few others that are outright bills that would directly limit that 1980 law.
So we've got our work cut out for us. I want to shift gears a little bit. You started to touch on this and just talk about what arguments are being put forth by the industry to promote it? And then I want you to basically to rebut those arguments. And what are the pros and cons?
The main arguments the industry makes are, you know, there's something old, something new, something borrowed, something very blue in it all, you know, as it ushers itself onto the stage of the climate crisis as our savior. One is the cost issue. And for many people, that is driving the debate. And there's quite a bit of research now available that debunks the claims of the industry that it's cheaper than fossil fuel and cheaper than renewables. And that is simply not the case. There's still about 90 reactors and maybe 50 some plants in the U.S., many fewer than the industry had hoped for in the 70s and 80s, far fewer. They haven't been built and they're not probably going to be built again because they are very, very expensive. And some of what makes them so expensive are the regulatory process that allows them to meet some kind of safety standards. So there are a lot of reasons why nuclear power is so expensive that no one is talking about reviving those big plants. But the designers and entrepreneurs promoting small reactors claim these are much cheaper. Any one small modular reactor may produce a lot less radioactive waste and at a cheaper cost. But when you roll out a lot of them, it's expensive. And many of the cost analyses by independent sources conclude that this actually would be a very expensive form of energy, far more expensive than renewables or fossil fuels.
How about the timeline? That seems to be a big part of the debate. Can they be built fast enough?
No. But for any of these designs to actually be completed, to go through a regulatory process, to ramp up to the scale that would be needed in responding to climate crisis, even if all their claims are correct, would be very hard to achieve, certainly before 15 years or so. And the way they want to designers want to move through the regulatory process more quickly also raises concern for many, including the Union of Concerned Scientists. That's part of the pitch here in Oregon. Well, these laws were developed with older designs in mind. We don't have the same safety problems, so we should be able to circumvent many of the regulatory requirements.
So the argument that they're somehow safer really doesn't hold any water is what I hear you saying.
There are many reasons to think they're far less safe. First, the whole concept behind them is to be built in factories and then shipped out to remote areas that don't have access to energy, and then having to dispose of radioactive waste on site. It's hard to conceive of rural communities or remote communities having the capacity to even do what is done now in places where the radioactive waste are stored. There's a proliferation problem of keeping the radioactive waste secure. There are all kinds of long-term problems. I mean, Native people talk about thinking about seven generations. The impact of what we do for seven generations. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of generations of life in uncertain circumstances, having to manage waste that cannot be in contact with humans or other living things. And there's an enormous hubris in this industry in claiming they can just safely package this stuff. And most of them don't even address the issue of radioactive waste. They kind of punt it. You know, it's the government's problem to figure it out. Now, the strongest argument I think they have made in response to the climate crisis is that many of the renewables are intermittent source of power when the sun doesn't shine or the wind isn't blowing, you know, there would be problems with unstable or intermittent sources of power, and that this is a problem to manage for the grid system we have. Clearly, there are engineering problems to still be worked out. And this is, for some, not a daunting problem. For others, it's a kind of deal breaker in selling nuclear. As a layperson, I would put my money on engineers figuring out the grid problem than the engineering and scientific problem of what to do with radioactive waste that cannot be anywhere near life forms for hundreds of thousands of years.
A lot of what you point to, Jan, it seems to me, speaks to the problem, kind of an underlying problem, that this is an initiative that is being driven by entrepreneurial interests instead of, say, approaching the climate crisis by turning over the problem to our community of scientists and technical experts, or allowing communities to take a more active role in deciding what kind of energy sources they're going to have in their communities. In other words, a democratic process. Speak to that just a little bit.
The climate crisis, like many crises, opens up a lot of anxiety, despair, and depression about the world we inhabit and the future we face. But it also opens up possibilities for forms of social transformation, new ways of doing things, and profound, even revolutionary changes. With the climate crisis, there are also calls for more democratic ways of thinking about energy with more local participation, forms of conservation. Do we need the vast amount of energy flowing through these big grid systems, or are there other ways of conserving? The Columbia River is a kind of character in the Last Necessity film, but also in this film, in what Lauren Goldberg with Columbia Riverkeeper describes as the workhorse of the Pacific Northwest. The way the Columbia River is harnessed has been detrimental to tribal communities. And this push now to build small modular reactors along the Columbia is another chapter in that tragic history. So I think listening to tribal communities that are also, by the way, not of one mind or one position on these issues, but have a wealth of wisdom and history and experience to draw on in thinking about what we should accept as progressive and what is regressive, it certainly requires more public discussion than it's received. The entrepreneurial advertising pitches of these SMR designs are very much like advanced capitalist thinking in general. You know, it's just-in-time ordering, buy one now, pay later, reverse mortgage your future. The pitches of this and the ways in which nuclear reactors worldwide have become kind of a prestige industry because it's associated with the threat of being able to create nuclear weapons, but also as a kind of signifier of being part of the modern nuclear age. But it's been a costly experiment, and I think particularly costly in this country and elsewhere to indigenous communities.
Well, let's get back to that then, because the whole nuclear industry, both the weapons and the power part of the industry, got its start at the Hanford installation.
Nuclear reservation, yeah.
Yeah, during World War II, where the plutonium was produced that was used in the first nuclear bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But that whole project entailed the forced displacement of four tribal communities, including the Yakima Nation and the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. So talk a little bit about that very troubling history of neocolonialism, really.
Russell Jim, Dr. Russell Jim, who was a beloved member of the Yakima Nation and really led the fight there to bring Indigenous voices into the discussion nationally of nuclear power and the costs of this industry, and the living lethal legacy of the industry, even far after the war effort, after the Manhattan Project. The Hanford Nuclear Reservation is itself a tragic and ongoing kind of graveyard of this industry and a legacy that it would like to forget. So the Indigenous people and other people who live in that region live with that history, and many of them are proud of being part of the development of nuclear weapons. And it was, by many standards, a phenomenal achievement how quickly scientists and engineers came to that area. They displaced people and developed a culture of secrecy that remained kind of a signature ethos of the industry, keeping their problems very secretive. The legacy of the development of nuclear weapons and plutonium there continued on after the war, as reactors were built to produce plutonium for the atomic weapons industry in the U.S. So it did not just end with the tragic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the repackaging of nuclear power through Atoms for Peace. The domesticating of nuclear power continued into the post-war era. The film and the historical elements of Atomic Bamboozle are meant to be a kind of recovery of cultural memory around this, and to be able to draw on that cultural memory that has been so actively repressed by the industry itself and by the Department of Energy. And at a minimum, we should be informed and guided by that history, as any wise person would be.
Well, Hanford is now considered, I believe, the single most contaminated place in the planet.
Yeah, it's largest Superfund site. Yeah. Billions and billions of dollars go into that and will continue to be needed for a cleanup. It's also a site of tremendous corruption of contractors who make a lot of money shuffling stuff around there. But nonetheless, really, our federal government needs to be held accountable for dealing with what remains a tremendous threat to not only local people, tribal peoples in the area, but to the Columbia River and the ongoing leaking of radioactive waste.
Jan, before we close, I first want to ask about the details about the showing on March 12th.
Yeah, this is very exciting for the team of us. All of the film projects carried out by me and a team of filmmakers are based on participatory methods where we have extensive consultations with participants and community groups who care about the issue. I mean, there's one approach that comes out of the field of journalism, filmmakers who have a journalistic background, where they do not show any of the rough cuts of their film to participants. So participants would only see a film when they see it with everybody else at a theater. I come out of participatory action research in field studies, where I have an opposite set of ethical guidelines, that it would be unethical through my training and background to not share work samples with participants to make sure that we've kind of landed on what people intend to communicate, whether participants feel they can support what I've used of the interviews in the film, whether there are research questions that still need to be addressed, but there's extensive community participation, and that community participation will be reflected in the screening, the premiere at Cinema 21 on the 12th. Some of the lead experts in the film will be on a panel, and we invite questions and responses from the audience. That's why I make films as an activist, as well as a psychologist and filmmaker, is to use this medium as a form of cultural memory, as a way of gathering up a history of experiences that are so often lost and marginalized on the way, that might be on the news for a moment a night, but otherwise left behind.
Well, and there's lots to be learned from excavating and reliving that history, too. So the details of the showing are...
Well, we encourage people to go onto our website, atomicbamboozle.com, or the Columbia River Keeper website, where there's an event page. It's a benefit for the Columbia River Keeper and the Oregon Conservancy Foundation. And people can start gathering at 2:30. There will be tables with information, materials available. The program will start at 3.
So, Jan, thank you very much for coming on to the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning and talking about your new film, Atomic Bamboozle, The False Promise of a Nuclear Renaissance. And we hope to see everyone on Sunday, March 12th.
Thanks so much, Patricia.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for March 6th, 2023. I'm John Nelson with one last pitch before wrapping things up here. And I know you're listening. Thanks to KBOO, the Old Mole Variety Hour has the chance every week to bring you segments like these. And this is your chance to support the Old Mole and this station. Just go to kboo.fm/give. And of course, a great big thank you to everyone who has supported us already during this All Thrills, No Frills campaign. Check out all the upcoming and archived specials at kboo.fm/thrills. And of course, while you're there, click on the donate button right up there in the top right-hand corner of your screen. It's you who make shows like this possible, so thank you for your support. That website, once again, kboo.fm/give. Thanks to Patricia Kohlberg, Larry Bolden, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests Jan Hocken and Jesse Hagopian. Don't forget Atomic Bamboozle premieres at Cinema 21 this Sunday, March 12th at 3 p.m. with informational tables at 2:30 that afternoon. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.